From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On our show today, a survivor of human trafficking fights back against the use of young sex slaves during the North American International Auto Show.
And every survivor that I've spoken to has been taken through Detroit at some point.
We talked to the state DNR wolf expert about the new law opening the door to wolf hunting in the Upper Peninsula and soon looking for public opinion.
This is a very polarized and passionate issue, so I think we'll get a lot of people chiming in.
And the first emergency manager to take over a city in Michigan will soon be out of a job. Benton Harbor's controversial EM Joe Harris is out.
You know, there was a lot of protests. Benton Harbor was sort of the focal point of that because it was the only city at the time that had an emergency manager.
Those stories and much, much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news.
The winners are chosen.
Welcome to Stateside for this Monday. I'm Cynthia Canty. Gray wolves in the Upper Peninsula are a step closer to being hunted this fall. That's because of a new state law designating the wolves as game animals. On today's show, we find out if a wolf hunt is indeed a possibility. Plus, it's estimated that 50% of Michiganders will be obese by 2030. Yeah, you heard that right. We'll talk to a group trying to find solutions to the obesity epidemic. But first, the Detroit Auto Show kicked off today, as it usually does, with the North American Car and Truck of the Year Awards. And it was a big day for the hometown automakers. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reports.
The winners are chosen by a panel of automotive journalists from across North America, and two of Detroit's big three car makers came out on top.
The winner of the 2013 North American Car of the Year is the Cadillac ATS.
The ATS is a small, Lansing-made luxury sedan. David Leone is an executive chief engineer with Cadillac.
This is a recognition that it's everything we wanted it to be.
Leone says the win is a big one. It proves that Cadillac and GM can compete with better-known luxury brands like the BMW.
As an industry, we're back, and General Motors is able to start to show that we can compete with the best in the world. And we can win.
The 2013 North American Truck of the Year was the Ram 1500. No, it's not the Dodge Ram anymore. The Ram brand has branched off on its own. Fred Diaz is president and CEO of the Ram brand. He says the 1500 offers 25 miles per gallon fuel efficiency and lots of new features without sacrificing its characteristic big truck appeal.
We are seeing research that more and more shows that customers are starting to buy a truck as their primary mode of transportation for their family's needs.
Diaz says the Ram win is a big deal for the Chrysler brand, too. Once the weakest of Detroit's three automakers, Chrysler has experienced a resurgence since it effectively merged with Italian automaker Fiat. It's now posting the largest sales gains of the Detroit three, led in large part by the Ram. At Cobo Center in Detroit, I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
Meantime, Toyota has dethroned General Motors as the world's top-selling automaker. The Japanese company says it sold 9.7 million cars and trucks last year worldwide, and they're still counting. GM says it sold 9.2 million. GM retook the crown in 2011 when Toyota's factories were hit by the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, but clearly the company has since recovered. GM was the top-selling automaker for more than seven decades before losing the title to Toyota in 2008. There is a big change on the way for Benton Harbor. The Southwest Michigan City's emergency manager, Joseph Harris, is being replaced February 1st. Harris had served as Benton Harbor's emergency manager since being appointed by former Governor Granholm in March of 2010. He's being replaced by Tony Saunders II of Detroit. Lindsay Smith covers West Michigan for Michigan Radio. She has followed the ups and downs of Joseph Harris's tenure in Benton Harbor, and she joins us now. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Cindy.
So, Lindsay, there were reports that Joseph Harris might leave even back in 2011, and he didn't. So what happened now? Why is he out?
It's a good question. To be totally honest, the state is not saying exactly why. They will say that it's a prudent time to make a switch that, despite Joseph Harris's best efforts, the city is still in a financial emergency. Now, some background, though, that the state will not acknowledge is the mayor of the city of Benton Harbor, an elected mayor, had made an agreement with the state to support a new special assessment on all property owners within the city. So not exactly a tax, but essentially agreed to support raising this fee to support public safety, police and fire. But he would only agree to do that if the state agreed to six conditions, one of them being replacing Joe Harris by February 1st. And there's letters out there that are public that have Roger Frazier, the deputy treasurer, agreeing to those terms. And then here we have it.
So it sounds like some good old fashioned backroom politicking.
I would say that this has been sort of an internal struggle. Now, the reason that this has really been a problem, I mean, Joe Harris has been really working hard to reduce the deficit, but he, as, you know, maybe a personality type, he hasn't been very open about communication with the press, with the community, with certainly the elected leaders, we argue with them, about how he's going about doing some of that stuff. So there has been sort of this, we want more information, Joe Harris won't give us enough information, cry for about a year now.
And he really, Joe Harris really became a lightning rod of sorts for critics of the EM law. I remember seeing Rachel Maddow just go insane about him. So was that criticism warranted in your view?
Well, I mean, I think that Joe Harris was one of the first people to take action under the old emergency manager law, PA-4, that Governor Snyder signed into law that gave him really sweeping powers that he didn't have when he first got appointed by Governor Granholm. And you know, there was a lot of protests. Benton Harbor was sort of the focal point of that because it was the only city at the time that had an emergency manager, and because he was the first one to really take advantage of it. So yeah, there was a lot of attention there. And to be honest, I think that's part of the reason why within the past year he's sort of clammed up, because, you know, you're working under this constant pressure to make changes. And at the same time, you're expected to explain these changes and people don't want to necessarily believe you, even if you tell them certain things. So, I mean, it's been, I see this whole focus on him and, you know, the powers that he had and what he did with it, and Rachel Maddow, and, you know, a lot of the national media, New York Times came in, and, you know, that may have very well played into why he sort of just said, look, I got to do what I got to do, and I don't need to tell you, so I'm not going to.
We can, by the way, assume that this departure was not necessarily Joseph Harris's idea, right? He has been replaced by Tony
Saunders. Not his idea.
And Tony Saunders II is going to be his replacement as of February 1st. Very, very young. What's his background?
He's graduated of University of Michigan, bachelor degree with a concentration in economics. He has been an advisor with the Department of Treasury for Highland Park, the city of Highland Park, since last April. So not a full year there. And he also has done some work with Detroit City Council members in the past to work on strategies to improve finances there. Of course, Detroit has its own financial problems. So, and then he is a partner at a marketing group.
WYLD Marketing. And
correct.
He is in his mid-20s. Is there anyone saying, wow, he's young for this, besides me?
Nobody has commented to me on that yet. I will say from sort of personal experience that you need someone with a lot of energy in Benton Harbor to have that job. I mean, it's a really stressful, you're working a ton of hours. You're dealing with a ton of personalities. It could be very frustrating. So his age may it could very well work in his favor in that respect.
Is there a sense from people in Benton Harbor that he would be a good fit? Tony Saunders will be a good fit for the people and the city?
I haven't had a chance to talk to too many people in Benton Harbor. Joe Harris is going to be holding a press conference on Wednesday. So I'll be down there later this week, and I'll definitely get a chance to talk to some people. Now, I will say, people in Benton Harbor almost unanimously were not very happy with Harris. So whether or not Saunders is a good fit may be a secondary point at this point.
They're just glad that Joe Harris is going to be heading out the door.
I would say that the majority of people are ready for a change.
So what should we watch for, Lindsay? What's next for the city?
It's interesting because Harris really has made some progress. He's made a lot of structural changes with city government. He's combined the police and fire department into a single department. He's made a lot of staffing changes. But as far as what's next, I mean, the city still has a deficit, about $2 million deficit at last check. You know, to be honest, I would look for progress with communication between elected leaders and the new emergency manager. If you see them working together, you know, sort of hand in hand, where that has not been the case with Joe Harris, I would say that that's an improvement.
And is the fact that Tony Saunders II is coming in now under this newest law, the one giving cities a little more control over their financial futures, do you think that sets him up in a better situation than Joe Harris?
Not necessarily, no, not at all. That law takes effect in March, from my understanding. And the major changes that I see in that law is going into an emergency, a financial emergency, that cities have options, or school districts have options, for what they want to do, whether or not they want to get an emergency manager. Once they have an emergency manager, I actually don't see too much difference. There is some difference in transitioning out of a financial emergency, but I really don't see how the new law is going to give the city of Benton Harbor too many changes. I think that the changes in leadership will be bigger than the ones that have changed in the law.
And in personality. So some very high hopes and some very heavy expectations for Tony Saunders.
I wish him all the best, man. Good luck.
Lindsay Smith, covering West Michigan for Michigan Radio News. Thanks so much, Lindsay.
Thank you.
And here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. Have thoughts about the Detroit Auto Show, or maybe what's happening in Benton Harbor? Let us know. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside to email us. We're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still to come, estimates suggest that by the year 2030, one in two Michiganders will be obese. A simply stunning statistic. Coming up in 15 minutes, we'll speak with a group trying to find healthy solutions. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Gray wolves in the Upper Peninsula are a step closer to being hunted this fall, thanks to a new state law designating wolves as game animals in Michigan. The gray wolf was protected for many years, but the wolf population has grown to the point where the wolf has been dropped from the endangered species list. The law approved by last year's lame duck legislature okayed the hunt and set license fees, but now state wildlife officials have to figure out the rest of the regulations for a wolf hunt and decide, indeed, if there will be a hunt at all. Let's take a closer look at the prospects for hunting wolves in Michigan as we welcome Adam Bump, who's a wolf specialist with the Michigan DNR. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Cindy. How are you?
Good. So take us back just a few weeks and recap for us exactly what was behind the push to approve the new law designating wolves as game animals in Michigan.
Well, I think I'd be speaking for legislators if I went too deeply into that. I believe the focus was, number one, to give the Department of Natural Resources the full range of options for wolf management. We have a 2008 wolf management plan that kind of dictates and gives direction for where we're headed, and public harvest is one of those options that's outlined in the plan. So I think part of the focus was to give us that. And otherwise, I think probably just after hearing from some of their constituents, they felt it was something that they wanted to move forward on, as giving us some of those tools.
And that's what I'm wondering, Adam. Was it born, when they're hearing from constituents, was this effort born out of conflicts between people and wolves?
Well, there certainly is a lot of conflict that exists surrounding wolves. So we have people on both sides of perspectives on wolf management, but there are conflicts that exist between humans and wolves in areas of the Upper Peninsula. So we've had consistent depredations over the years where wolves are preying on livestock. We have some occasional issues with wolves preying on hunting dogs. And then we've had some human safety issues in some of the communities in the western UP. So I think those three things together are probably some of the primary concerns that we've heard from residents and probably that legislators have heard as well.
How many wolves do we have now in Michigan, and how does that compare with what's considered to be an optimal level?
Well, the management plan that we have does not outline a population objective, and the reason for that is for most species, especially some of these larger predators, population levels are probably going to be dictated both by biology and by what we call social carrying capacity, so the number of animals that society can tolerate. Mm. And so we wanted to have some flexibility and manage based on those aspects, making sure we're maintaining biologically appropriate numbers, but also socially appropriate numbers. But right now, we have our last minimum winter estimate was conducted in 2011, and we had a minimum of 687 wolves then. We're currently doing a new monitoring survey right now. It will run January for the next couple months here. So by, say, around April, we will have a new winter estimate for wolves.
And can you give us an idea with that number of 687? How does that compare to, say, where we were 10 years ago?
Wolves have steadily increased since they came back into the Upper Peninsula. So every year we've had a steady increase. And over the last 10 years, the rate of increase has been pretty significant. So we've had a steady growth of wolves over the last 10-year period. So wolves are doing pretty well. We think that the population growth rate may be slowing down a little bit right now, but we're kind of excited to see the new survey results to see where they're at now.
So the law gets passed by the lame duck legislature, and now what is next?
What's happened since then already is the act was signed, I believe it was December 28th.
Yes.
So at our December Natural Resource Commission, the Natural Resource Commission asked the Wildlife Division, which ended up being me, to present an update on wolves, where we're at now that they are designated as a game species, and what we think is a reasonable timeline. And from our perspective, we think after examining the wolf management plan and what it speaks to in regards to public harvest, that there's enough evidence in our data and in the situations that exist in the Upper Peninsula to move forward with discussions about the use of public harvest to resolve conflicts. So we have a very specific charge in the plan, and that is it endorses the use of public harvest to resolve conflicts, not as a straight, broad-scale recreational harvest, but okay, to resolve specific management issues. And so we outlined a timeline that would include engagement with our Wolf Forum, which is a group of stakeholders, about 20 organizations that are kind of our sounding board for wolf management issues, as well as with the general public, to have those discussions, provide data, provide a perspective through the lens of that wolf management plan, and come up with a recommendation by probably June of this year.
If you just joined us, we are talking with Adam Bump of the State DNR, a wolf specialist. And Adam, let's just jump ahead and let's say the commission approves of and sets up a wolf hunt. So what would the goal be of a hunt beyond reducing the wolf population in a given area? Could it also be a way of making the wolves more cautious around humans?
Right. The specific goal wouldn't necessarily be for population reduction, although that may be one part of the goal. The overall goal would be to try to resolve conflicts in specific situations. So okay. We'd be looking at, you know, if we have human safety issues in the Ironwood area or area of the state where we're having consistent livestock depredations that we've tried other techniques and have not had successes, we'd be implementing the harvest to try to reduce those conflicts. That could be through reducing the population. It could also be, as you suggested, through changing wolf behavior through harvest. So as wolves learn that people pose a risk, they may be more reluctant to okay. move into urban areas. They may be more susceptible to some of the non-lethal techniques. So you know, they just have that added element of cautiousness that makes them more willing to respond to non-lethal techniques. So the overall objective isn't necessarily population related, it's conflict resolution.
Now, Adam, you did talk about the idea of public comment, and certainly this is a highly charged issue. We had one comment, I'm sure it's typical of the kind of things you're hearing. We got this on our webpage, and the quote was, "If you can't eat it, it should not be hunted." Why do you think the prospect of a wolf hunt fires people up so much, both for and against?
Well, I think you have probably for similar reasons on both sides. You have a species that's a top-level carnivore, so they're out preying on other things that may be species that people may want to go after, such as deer or small game. And so there's that competitive nature there. There's also the fear element. Especially in European history, wolves are something that you read fairy tales about and have a stereotype of fear about them. So I think those could be some reasons why people may be focused on nervousness about wolves that is probably not well-founded but exists, so they have those issues. Four, you have people that just they view wolves as culturally significant. So we have tribal involvement where wolves are extremely culturally significant. So just the idea of having a harvest is not acceptable to them. For others, it may be this animal is a symbol of wilderness, and it's also the ancestor of domestic dogs, and it just is characterized in a way that makes it hard for people to accept the idea of allowing harvest of those animals.
Adam, what kind of timetable are you looking at? And even more importantly, what's the best way for concerned citizens to express their views on this?
Well, the timeline, we're looking at a series of public meetings that would occur in, it looks like mid-March. We're going to probably do those spread out across the state. Between now and then, we'll develop some other opportunities for input. So we'll provide information at those meetings and give people the opportunity to provide input. Should a proposal come forward for the Natural Resources Commission to consider, because they are the decision-making body on this issue, I expect that would go before them around June, and those meetings we'll outline a lot of opportunities for people to give us input before we develop any recommendations, and then they always have the opportunity to comment to the commission as they're making their decision.
And I get the feeling you are expecting a lot of comments.
Oh, yeah, I think we'll get a lot of comments. This is a very polarized and passionate issue, so I think we'll get a lot of people chiming in.
Adam Bump with the Michigan DNR, our wolf specialist. Thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside. I'm sure we'll be talking as this unfolds through the year.
Thank you. Sounds great.
And proof that this is indeed an issue that Michiganders feel passionate about comes word today that a coalition of conservation, animal welfare groups, and Native American tribes have joined together. They call themselves Keep Michigan Wolves Protected. They've launched a referendum campaign with a goal of gathering 225,000 voter signatures by late March in order to put the wolf issue on the November 2014 ballot. So it seems the more that we as a nation, as a state, as a community, in our own homes, the more we talk about obesity and talk about the need to eat smart and work out, the worse our obesity rates are getting. It's estimated a full 50% of Michiganders will be obese by 2030. Shape Michigan is a statewide effort to seek out answers to Michigan's obesity crisis. The second Shape Michigan event happened over the weekend at Grand Rapids. Dr. Tom Peterson led discussions about obesity at the event. He's the executive director of Quality, Safety, and Community Health at Helen DeVos Children's Hospital, and he joins us now from Grand Rapids. Dr. Peterson, as a pediatrician for the last 20 years or so, you've pretty much been right on the front line in the state's war on obesity. Those young patients are the ones who could grow up to be obese adults. So why has it been so hard to reverse our state's obesity rate?
Well, I think the obesity thing, one thing about it is it's a new phenomenon. You know, it's really only been designated as an epidemic since the late 70s and 80s in this country. So if you look at it historically, it's very, very, very new. I worked in the tobacco control area for the last 35 years, and that is a phenomenon we've worked on for 100 years and really started having the major effects in cutting smoking rates and so on in the last maybe 10 years. So it takes time. We don't have as much time, I think, with this problem. But it's a multitude of problems. It's an environmental problem. It's a society problem. Every aspect of society has to be involved in the process, which is very difficult to do sometimes. We don't have healthcare systems set up to manage it the way it should be because it's a new thing. When healthcare was set up, we didn't have the obesity problem. So it's very difficult to get everybody together under one roof to really drive the improvements.
But am I wrong in that observation that I made at the beginning of our interview, that the more we all focus on and obsess on what we eat and working out and the need for exercise, the fatter we're getting? So because it's not a secret, we need to do these things. And we've been talking about them for decades.
You know, we've talked about quitting smoking since like the 1950s. So there comes a time, I think, when it almost hits a tipping point. It's unfortunate in our society that things, if they don't have immediate effects or immediate dramatic effects, we don't respond to them right away. But I think, you know, as City of Michigan, you can say, well, we were 10th in the nation last year, and now we're 5th in the nation. So, you know, if we want to have a call to action any place in the country, the state of Michigan should be one because we are one of the worst in the country with obesity rates, and our rates are going up and up and up every year. I think one thing that we've learned, which is very exciting to me in the last few months, is that local communities can really have a significant effect on this problem.
How so?
Well, what we've seen for the first time ever in 2012, where local communities such as New York City and Philadelphia have actually decreased their rates of childhood obesity from their efforts over the previous 5 to 6 to 7 years. And what it does is it shows that a local community, if it has the right leadership, can really drive and bring together the right sectors to do everything. So if you look this up under the New York City piece that you can Google, you'll see that it was the schools involved, and they had policy changes. And then the city was involved, where it put the produce in the green carts all over the city so you had access. And they changed the access for biking throughout the city. Government involvement. And there was physician. They had health care and hospital involvement. So they included all the components and drove it in a very coordinated way. And there were positive results for the first time ever that we've seen.
Dr. Tom Peterson is talking with us today on Stateside. He's the Executive Director of Quality, Safety, and Community Health at Helen DeVos Children's Hospital, talking about obesity in Michigan and what it will take to reverse our rate of obesity. So you say we're 5th in the nation. What is it about our state? Why is it, do you think, Dr. Peterson, that we're so fat?
It's tough to say because people could say, well, the thinnest state is Colorado and everybody's out there biking and hiking, or they have better weather. And then you say, well, but Minnesota is a very thin state and they're colder than we are. Hmm. So I think it has a lot to do with our culture, our societies. It has a lot to do with, I think, how our states have been led or not led in these areas. We have very poor controls of our schools with phys ed in the state of Michigan, one of the worst in the country. Of our requirements for phys ed, you know, every day or activity every day, for we don't have that. There's statewide policies that could be brought into this. I think our healthcare systems have done some things, but they could do much more. We have a pretty sedentary component to this state, but we also, if you look at it, our children, the childhood obesity rates in Michigan are not as bad as the adults. So the adults are 5th and the kids are about in the 20s. we're about in the middle. So we're not as bad as some of the other states in the childhood obesity area. So hopefully that's a sign of what's to come as they grow up.
Yeah, that they will carry that through. And right. Sounds like really a lot of it is the front line is in the schools and in probably in offices of pediatricians across Michigan.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, there could be some very basic things done that I think would have profound impacts. I think, like I mentioned, some of the changes you do with city structures and so on, so people have access to activities. But if you look at schools, if we could just make our schools, you know, 150 minutes a week or so, that's what they did in New York, that they had to be active 30 minutes a day. And that was a policy that every school had to do. Our kids have better MEEP scores and better academics when they're more active, and we know that. That would be a huge piece. And then another one from our provider side, if doctors became more engaged with a child obesity efforts. You know, we've only had guidelines out for this for 5 years in the pediatric world, so it's a very new thing. So doctors who've been out for 20 years might not know how to manage this very well. Resources, where do they send the kids when they have problems? The way you manage this over time, it's a process. It's not a cure that we get from a surgery or a pill. Engagement of the families, you know. So, but there's some very evidence-based messages we can give. You know, if you have five fruits and vegetables a day, there's evidence to that. If you have as many home-cooked meals a week as you can get at home, there's less calories that you take in. If you have breakfast every day of the week, you're less likely to be obese as a child. You know, if the parents are active, the kids are six times more likely to be active. You know, so we have, if you have more than 8 hours of sleep a day, the kids are less likely to be obese. So there's some very direct messages that doctors can give, health plans can give, parents can give, schools can give, et cetera, that I think could have big impacts if we do this collectively as a community.
Those are very doable suggestions that you give. And it isn't a matter of cost or spending money on things. It's a matter of changing the way you think about approaching activity and eating.
Absolutely. What the doctors or the schools have to understand is it's goal setting. And this is a new way that we have to manage a problem with in healthcare. Is it's not that we're going to cure them with an antibiotic. We have to set goals. If they go to a fast food restaurant 5 days a week, well, we might want to get them down to 2 days a week. I mean, it's a process that they have to do over 3 months and 6 months and 9 months. And our healthcare system's not very good at that. They don't pay for that. They don't reimburse for that. They don't train in that very well. That's not how our doctors are trained. So it's a tough thing to get into their psyche to do this.
Dr. Tom Peterson is with the Helen DeVos Children's Hospital in Grand Rapids. He took part in the Shape Michigan event this past weekend. We've put a link to Shape Michigan on our website at michiganradio.org. You can check out events and resources in your corner of Michigan. Coming up next, a survivor of sex trafficking has made it her mission to raise awareness about this terrible crime. That story next on Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we mentioned earlier in the show, the North American International Auto Show opens to the public this Saturday. But amidst the shiny cars and the excitement of the auto show, there is a dark underside. With all of these visitors coming to Detroit, sex is being bought and sold. And that opens a much-needed conversation about the horrors of human trafficking happening right here in Michigan. Teresa Flores heads the group SOAP, Save Our Adolescents from Prostitution. And once again, Teresa and her volunteers have reached out in hopes of helping the young victims of human trafficking. And this is more than just a cause for Teresa Flores. As a teenager growing up in Michigan in affluent Birmingham, she became the young victim of human trafficking as part of a sex ring. Teresa Flores joins us from her home in Ohio. Teresa, put us all on the same page. When you talk about human trafficking, exactly what are we talking about?
Well, anytime you force somebody, manipulate them or blackmail them into any form of commercial sex or labor, that's human trafficking. The other part of it that a lot of people don't realize is that if you're under the age of 18 and you're involved in any form of commercial sex, even if, you know, it doesn't seem as if they're being forced, it's automatically human trafficking. So there really is no such thing as teen prostitution in our country because we don't feel that kids have their, you know it all to make those kind of decisions to be involved in that.
And you are proof that human trafficking can ensnare just about anyone's teenager. If you will, share your story with us. You grew up in Birmingham.
Yep, ran track and was, you know, pretty involved. Went to the football games and just, you know, a normal kid with two parents and not abused or run. I wasn't a runaway. I didn't do drugs. Just a normal kid and was targeted by a group of guys in my high school. And just, you know, one of the guys particularly just spent a lot of time being nice to me and, you know, saying I was pretty and offering to hold my books and help me with homework. And one day he offered me a ride home from school. And, you know, here I am, a 15-year-old girl and have a crush on him by now and
sure.
Didn't think anything of it. I was very excited. And unfortunately, he didn't take me home. He took me to his house, which was in Southfield, and proceeded to drug me and then raped me. And if that wasn't bad enough, a few days later he came to me and said, you know, my older cousins were there as well, and they've taken these pictures, and they want you to earn them back or else.
Wow.
Mm-hmm,
so
yeah.
The or else was you had to be with the cousins?
Oh, yeah. You know, very many people over the course of 2 years, they would call my room, my house in the middle of the night and, you know, tell me I needed to come immediately, and they would deliver me to very beautiful houses all around Birmingham, Farmington Hills, Rochester, wherever, and then take me back home around 4 in the morning, and I would kind of sneak back inside and go to bed for a few hours and get up for school the next day, and nobody had any idea.
Okay. As the mother of a teenage girl, and you know I have to ask this, how could you not go to your parents to say, help, what was going on?
Well, my dad worked a lot. He traveled a lot and had a very, very big job, made a lot of money. And these guys said, you know, if you don't do what we say, we're going to show these pictures to your dad's boss. All right, we know where he works. This is the address of his building. This is the name of his boss. We'll show them to your dad. We'll post them around school. And we'll, you know, even give them to the priests at church. So
yeah.
Me, you know, I really was thinking I was just going to do whatever they asked, which I didn't even know what it was,
mm-hmm.
a couple times and it'd be over. But that wasn't the way it worked out. And then as things progressed, they would, you know, threatened to kill my brothers and my family. So this threat got a lot worse.
And this went on for how long?
2 years.
So pretty much through your high school?
Yeah, until we moved my senior year of high school.
And that's how you got away?
Yep.
Wow. Now, as you're telling me this, my heart is dropping. Were you ever able to follow up? Was your trafficker caught and was he punished?
No, they still live there in the area.
When you were being called out on your rounds at 4 in the morning and getting that phone call and they were taking you places, Who were these customers? Were they other kids? Were they old people? Who were the customers?
And they were not kids. They were probably, you know, in their 20s up to maybe 50s, all within this group of people. But, you know, just men of every age.
Men of every age. And where would you meet them? Would you be at their homes? Would you be at hotels? Where would they take you?
Initially, I didn't go to any hotels. I was always taken to people's homes, private residences that were very, very nice, and taken usually downstairs to, like, finished basement areas, where there'd be a bedroom. On one particular night, they switched things up, and they kidnapped me, basically, and they took me to a motel in the inner city of Detroit.
It absolutely breaks my heart thinking of you as this 15- and 16-year-old girl, that you mm-hmm. were so locked in the fear that they set up around you that you couldn't tell a teacher or a classmate. So really, yeah. No one knew?
No, I think there definitely were signs. You know, there definitely were times where, you know, I was falling asleep in class. These mm-hmm. older guys were around me a lot, really making me intimidated. You could definitely tell something was going on. But, I mean, even one time in class, there was a teacher, and I was, you know, going into class, and the two of the guys who were trafficking me, the older guys, had said, you know, you need to come now. And I was like, I've got class. And they're just like, we don't care. And they're like, you know, really grabbing my arm and saying, you're leaving now. And the teacher was like, she has class. And they're like, she's coming with us. And she was like, okay. She, you know, this teacher was very intimidated by these guys, too. So, okay. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, talking with Teresa Flores from the group SOAP, Save Our Adolescents from Prostitution. She was a young victim of human trafficking and now works to stop human trafficking, including at the North American International Auto Show this week in Detroit. Once you moved away, how did mm-hmm. the recovery begin? And was there a conversation with your parents at any point then to say, here's what's been going on?
It took many years. It took about 5 years for me to kind of put all the pieces together. I do remember calling the police a couple years after when I was in college and kind of was thinking, you know, this was wrong and this, they should, you know, they're probably doing it to someone else now. And so I called the police and they're like, you know, we really can't help you. You're not here. This is, you know, years later, you know, sorry. And so I just kind of shoved it away again, and then a few years later happened to talk to my mom and dad about. But again, it was kind of one of those things, well, just kind of, you know, that was horrible, but go on with your life.
Wow. It strikes me that just about every bit of what might be a safety net wasn't there for you.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't have a good support network, even though I had loving parents. I didn't have aunts and uncles or teachers that, you know, saw change because I was new there. So I was, you know, the perfect vulnerable kid.
What do parents need to watch for?
Sure. Kids making a change in their behavior and hanging around different groups of kids, maybe a lot older kids, older boys, not really being able to account for where they're going, and maybe starting to do drugs. Their grades are dropping. They're always tired. But those are things that, you know, sound like a kid that's an at-risk kid in trouble, too. So it's really tough.
Especially if the child is afraid, as you were, and isn't going to give that information up. So what conversations do parents need to have with their sons and daughters?
Really telling your daughters that they're pretty every day, you know. It's okay to do that, especially for fathers to tell them that, or some male figure in their life. Because that way, when these pimps approach them in the mall and tell them that, it's not going to be any big deal for them to hear that. That's essential, is giving them good self-esteem. And really, for boys, we want boys to see women as an equal, as, you know, looking at another girl as it potentially could be his sister, you know, and mm-hmm. treating girls with respect.
Now it's your mission as the head of Save Our Adolescents from Prostitution to try to keep this from happening to other children, and you are, and your volunteers coming to the auto show. And tell us, how do you intervene? How do you try to reach these young victims?
Well, unlike my situation, many of them now do go to the motels. There, a lot of them are runaways, or they get tricked and, you know, by these smooth-talking guys to come out with them, and then they drug them, and they put them up on Backpage.com or other sites, and they sell them, and they take them to hotels where they have guys come all night long. And anytime there's a large amount of people coming to a city, we see a spike in those ads. These pimps who are traffickers bring in girls from all around the country. Hmm. And every survivor that I've spoken to has been taken through Detroit at some point. And so we make it our mission to go out to cities, particularly around big events, not because of the event, but because these traffickers are opportunists.
Sure.
And looking to make money.
So you go to the motels and hotels, and you're handing out soap. What's the importance of the bars of soap, Teresa Flores?
Well, when I was taken and kidnapped and left in that motel room, I went to the bathroom afterwards and I washed up. And it was the only time I was able, you know, to be alone and to think. And so on a night when I was leaving Detroit after doing a talk there, I had a flashback, and I just kind of realized that that's where we need to reach out to these girls, is in that bathroom. And on the bars of soap, it says, are you being threatened to do something against your will? Are you able to leave? Are you witnessing young girls being prostituted? If so, call this number. And it has the National Human Trafficking Hotline number on it.
And if someone is able to get away and make that call, what happens then? Let's say someone's listening right now to us.
Sure.
And they're here. First of all, what is that hotline number? Because somebody may be listening and want to make the call.
Yeah, it's 1-888-3737-888.
3737-888. Now, here's the question. What happens when they make the call? How can a child be taken away safely, and how do they get away?
Well, it goes to an organization called the Polaris Project in Washington, D.C. It's manned 24 hours a day. It's in, like, 28 languages. And they know locally who's been trained. So if they know, you know, for instance, Oakland County Sheriff's Department has been trained in this, that's who they're going to call. If they know of a shelter or an organization that is, you know, equipped to taking victims immediately, then that's who they'll call. Or, you know, if it's a really bad situation, they'll call 911 and they'll get that girl the help that she needs to immediately.
Meaning showing up at the ABC motel or hotel at that spot, and she can say, I'm in room 256, and there they
are. Exactly. Yep, exactly.
And getting them out of there. In 2010, the Michigan Women's Foundation found that in Michigan alone, about as many as 160 girls were being sold for sex online or through escort services. Mm-hmm. Do you think that number is too high, too low?
No, and that's on any given day, because I do monitor those things as well. Mm. So if you think of 160 girls and women being sold on any given day, during an event like this that's coming to the city, it quadruples. So you're talking, you know, hundreds and hundreds of girls every night being sold on there.
What about boys?
Boys are 20%. We do see this in boys as well. It's just really hard to rescue them. And I know of only one organization in the whole United States that helps boys survive, and it's actually in Michigan.
And you've been doing this for a while now. How many years have you come to the auto show?
This was our second year to come.
Okay.
So we've been doing soap for 3 years. And next week we go to New Orleans for the Super Bowl. And last year we got out, I think, 15 cases of soap, which is 15,000 bars of soap. And this past weekend we got out probably about 40,000 bars.
And did you have any success stories when you came to Detroit last year?
Oh, yeah. We had a couple girls that were recognized immediately by motel staff that were on the missing children's list.
So you talk to the motel staff as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All the volunteers are loaded up with soap and missing children posters, and they head on out to the motels and have a conversation with them. They educate them, and they're looking for missing kids, and we just give the soap free to the motels.
What is it that an average citizen could or should do, Teresa, to fight back against human trafficking?
Really, awareness is key. Getting speakers to come in to their church, to their organization, if they're in a civic club or their kid's school, and saying, we need to know about this. This is the second leading crime in the world, and no one's really talking about it. And this is unacceptable. So really, awareness and education is key. And then just really, you know, starting to be nosy neighbors again, you know, the time when Aunt Bees were like living next door. And it's okay to look out for each other and to talk to each other. And it's just, we need to get back to that kind of a society.
And Teresa, what would your call to action be to legislators and law enforcement? Because it makes me wonder, based on the response that you got when you called the police to report your situation after the fact, it was kind of a ho-hum approach. How responsive are they to this?
They're getting better. Again, we're having to educate law enforcement and legislation that this is something that we really do need some strong laws against. Michigan has a pretty good law. They have prosecuted quite a few traffickers, actually, but they're attempting right now to pass a bill called the Safe Harbor Law, where it means that you can't arrest a kid for prostitution. And that's really important, because a lot of times people look at these kids and say, oh, they're just, you know, they just want to do that. They're just being a prostitute. And that's not true. Nobody wants to have sex with 15 strangers every night. She just doesn't know how to get out and doesn't know how to tell anybody. So really, passing that law would be key.
Teresa, what would you say to your traffickers if you could talk to them face-to-face right now, today?
Wow. Oh, man. I don't know. That's a really good question. Maybe why me?
Yeah.
Were there others?
Teresa Flores of Save Our Adolescents from Prostitution, SOAP, and as part of the group's efforts to fight human trafficking, SOAP is next heading to the Super Bowl in New Orleans, January 25th and 26th. You can learn more, including ways to volunteer, by going to their website, which is trafficfree.com, and that's TRAFFICKFREE. And we have put a link for that site up for you at michiganradio.org. Teresa, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cindy Candy. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk tomorrow at 3:00.